Welcome to And the Writer Is with Ross Golan. There are millions of singers, thousands of artists, and only 40 songs per genre at a time. These are the stories of the hottest creatives, the most venerable legends, artists, songwriters, executives, and more. Come join our Discord, follow our socials, and share your music with the And the Writer Is community. We'll see you all there, and now, here's this week's episode.
Hey, what's up? It's Paige MacDonald, and this is your weekly music industry update. With revenues of $510 million in H1, Latin music is still on course to generate $1 billion in the U.S. this year. SoundCloud just launched a new creator dashboard and a new name for its artist services platform, now dubbed SoundCloud for Artists. Hipgnosis has struck a partnership with SongClip, which is a tech platform for integrating licensed music in apps. TikTok parent ByteDance is in talks with labels to expand music streaming services to 12-plus new markets. Muddy Waters Estate has signed a global admin deal with Sony Music Publishing. After scrapping sales plans, BMI has transitioned to a for-profit business model. Probably Nothing is launching a Web3 label with Warner Records. Blink-182 is reuniting and has announced a classic lineup with Tom DeLonge for their 2023 world tour. Warner Music has acquired a stake in the Serbian label Maskum Records. Julie Greenwald has been promoted to chairman and CEO of the newly created Atlantic Music Group. Lily Golightly has joined Verve Label Group as Senior Vice President of Publicity. Position Music has hired A&R executive Sam Sklar to join their A&R team. Sony Music Publishing UK has signed hitmaker Lost Boy. A big thank you to Charlotte Isidore of Mega House for gathering today's news. Now stay tuned for this week's episode of And the Writer Is.
Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. This week's Smash producers built their careers up from the NYU dorms in, obviously, New York City all the way to the Grammys. They've helped define some of music's biggest stars while still composing records left of center of the broader musical culture. Their work pushes boundaries from Afrobeats to grime, Latin trap to garage, country to pop to alt, etc., etc., etc. And from their breakout Sheck Wess's Mo Bamba to executive producing multi-platinum star Lil Nas X's debut album, these guests have only brushed the surface of their inevitable monumental career. I mean, they're not even 30 years old, and the writer is... are David Burrell and Denzel Baptiste, aka Take a Day Trip.
Yeah.
What's up?
That was amazing. Intro. Yeah, that was a great intro.
Best intro we ever had.
Gentlemen, it is a pleasure. I was just saying to David, Denzel, before you came, I was saying that I always feel like you guys are in all of the sessions. I feel like every time I'm like, oh, I'm in with, they're like, oh, yeah, I just did a record with Take a Day Trip. Or like they're, they're going to be in with Take a Day Trip. Or they're, like, it feels like you guys are in a lot of places at once. Is that because there are two of you? Or is that just because you guys have a crazy work ethic?
Honestly, we go everywhere together when it comes to making music. So probably the second one, which is we just like to make music. Like, truly, you know?
Well, but I want to go to, the beginning of your story because, you know, some of it's notorious. Anybody knows you guys or knows of you guys, to actually meet in the dorm is kind of like every, you know, aspiring musician's dream is to know that they could find their music life mate, you know, in something like school. But you guys had 18 years before that. So I kind of want to just go and, you know, each of you have a different story, but I want to hear a little bit of how you guys ended up in the dorm together when one of you's from New Jersey, one of you's from Virginia. So, Vermont. Sorry, my bad. And it's new. It started with a V. Okay, so so let's just start. You know, David, tell me a little bit about your childhood. I mean, what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was born in Providence, Rhode Island, and spent my first 13 years there. But it was when my mom got a job in Vermont that me and my family moved up, like right after my seventh grade year. And there happened to be a little DJ school on this like little tiny street called Church Street. And you know, quite literally called Church Street, there's like a church at the top of it. And it's like that the tallest building in Burlington, Vermont, like super tiny town. It's like 30,000 people. But you know, like snowboarding and ski culture is like really big there. And you have like Burton Snowboards and like Ben and Jerry's was started there. So every now and then we have like these X Games like events and things like that happening. So, you know, at the time where, you know, DJing is starting to serve a big purpose, like in that world, there happened to be a little DJ school that you know started up on that street, and my buddy Zach Johnson was my teacher for, you know, maybe the first 4 years, and I met a bunch of kids there and just got really obsessed with it. And it was kind of my first introduction to music outside of the radio. You know, it was like a whole history lesson of really just hip hop, like from the late 80s all the way, you know, to I guess that year might have been like 2008 or something like that, you know. But I got really obsessed with just everything that I didn't know. I think through that really inspired me to want to, you know, start dreaming about wanting to be in music. And early on, like my parents put me in lessons for like conga drums and piano. Like I was classically trained for, you know, 8-9 years, like did jazz training for 4 years. And, you know, really loved it, but there wasn't the same freedom that I got from DJing. And when I heard about the Clive Davis School when I was like a junior or senior in college, or sorry, in high school, and you know, me and my dad used to go down to New York City a bunch to like see Knicks games. So it was like this perfect situation where I was like, this is the exact place I want to go. This is the dream that I want to chase. And this is where I want to learn how to make music, you know? So at the time I didn't even know how to produce. I didn't know how to do any of that. I had a knowledge of obviously playing keyboards and, you know, being in jazz band and playing conga drums and all that kind of stuff, but I had no idea how to sit in front of a computer and like actually, you know, be able to structure something out. And you know, fortunate enough to get accepted to the Clive Davis Institute, and you know, was fortunate enough to meet Denzel my freshman year, and you know, we kind of geeked out on all our early influences of just stuff that I was into, stuff that he was into, like kind of, you know, flip flop the things that we're into. I taught him how to DJ. He taught me how to produce. And then just over time, we kind of started to lock into a rhythm and really, really figured out what our flow was, you know. But that was my beginnings, you know. Really, to me, it started in Burlington, Vermont, where the interest of wanting to be in music happened. And before that was kind of the boot camp of, you know, getting into playing piano, getting into playing conga drums and not really knowing where it was going to take me. But, you know, my parents were like, this is something you got to do. And I'm grateful that they did it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you obviously have really good parents and supportive parents. Did you have siblings, or were you in this journey alone?
I was in this journey alone.
And, I mean, for parents to say in Vermont that you should pursue the music industry or even look at the Clive Davis Institute feels like really progressive thought process. I mean, I guess you weren't, you know, born there. You're born in Providence, but that also isn't necessarily like a hotbed for the music industry. Were they, I guess, I mean, how were they supportive of a music career coming from sort of, I don't want to say the boondocks because Burlington is not the boondocks, but it's the middle of nowhere, you know? It's like, yeah. It's like, how did they know that the music industry was a viable, you know, job for their kid?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it wasn't it wasn't all flowers the whole way. You know, I definitely had to do a lot of convincing, and you know, I had to prove it essentially. So when I was DJing in high school, my DJ partner, who I was DJing with at the time, was still one of my best friends. This guy named Josh Decatur, and you know, went to the same DJ school together, and through that DJ school, they started giving us opportunities to, you know, DJ a Burton event or like do a little showcase at this venue called Higher Ground, which was like the only concert venue in all of like Burlington, Vermont. And I guess my junior, senior year, there's a couple kids in my high school that wanted to throw these rave parties. And I happened to be the only kid in my whole high school that knew how to DJ. So obviously I was going to be the DJ that got booked. And, you know, I wanted it to work so badly that I remember I'd go around my high school and I'd be like, these are the last five tickets left. And there'd be like, you know, 700 tickets left to sell. But I'd be like, these are the last five tickets left. And like, sell them real fast to five kids. Go to the next five group of people. Sell them real fast to the next five kids. And, you know, my junior, senior year, me and Josh used to throw these raves that we'd bring out like 800, 900 kids in Burlington, Vermont that, you know, really had probably not much to do except, you know, just have fun with, you know, at these raves and try to dodge the snow and all that kind of stuff. And was fortunate to have a bunch of supportive friends that shot videos of it and all that kind of stuff. And that ended up being like when you apply to the Clive Davis program, you have to, you know, showcase a video and write a bunch of essays and all this kind of stuff. But that video, I think, really is what helped put me in place to get accepted to that program. And at the time I was like writing a blog and had all these other things going on. Like I was just really interested in trying to get out of Vermont, but be a part of the culture that, you know, I was obsessed with, and was fortunate enough to be able to do a lot of cool things in high school that, you know, put together a really strong portfolio. And I think when my parents saw that, it kind of clicked in their mind, like, oh, okay, like maybe our son is capable of, you know, being actually able to do this because people are actually showing up, you know. But when I told my mom about the Clive Davis Institute, and it was like, yeah, only like 40 kids get in and things like that, my mom was like, all right. And my mom works in education, my dad works in education, my mom was like, all right, if you're gonna apply to this school, here's 18 other schools I want you to apply to too. And literally for like months I was just writing essays for all these other programs, you know, my mom being like, hey, you're a black kid like from Vermont. You might want to look at like applying to these schools in Maine because they don't have that many black kids. Like you'll probably get in pretty easy, but they're really good schools, you know. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, hell no! Like I do not want to do that.
Exactly right.
You know, and I remember me and my dad were on a way to a Knicks game. We were driving down to New York City, and we used to do that like once a month. You know, tickets were super cheap because the Knicks sucked, but we loved going to New York. Loved going to the games, and. On my way to New York, I remember opening up my email one day and it was like, you've been accepted to the Clive Davis Institute of, you know, recorded music. And me and my dad were just so stoked, call my mom on my phone. Like, you know, she's like out of her mind excited, you know, like almost like it was almost a dream that like I wanted, but wasn't sure if it was actually obtainable, you know, like 40 kids get in, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I was fortunate to get in, and it's like it's this memory in my mind that I can always repeat, and I remember it so perfectly, you know. And and that was kind of the first moment where I was like, maybe I could actually do this outside of my little town in Vermont, and, you know, expand past the little 30,000, you know, person town that I'm from. And
how does that experience compare to, you know, hearing a song on the radio? Does it compare to that? And you're like you light up so much when you talk about finding out you got into that school. Do you think of that moment on the same level that you would, you know, finding out that you're nominated for a Grammy?
A little bit. I think it's a little different because as a 17, 18 year old kid, that was like the opportunity of being like, you can actually escape this tiny town and be a part of something that is your dream, you know? And I think me and Denzel, like when we did get nominated for Grammys and everything like that, we had been in the music industry for so long, like working up to that moment, that it was kind of like, I think it was something that we could predict a little bit easier in terms of the amount of work and effort and time that we put into it. Like obviously being nominated for a Grammy is like, hell yeah, like dream come true. Like, never would have thought that as the 17-year-old kid, like driving to New York City with my dad, getting accepted to NYU. But that moment specifically, I think, is probably the most special moment that I've ever had, as like someone being like, oh, for the first time in my life, this is actually something that I could do.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think a lot of people think that the goal in life is a trophy or something else, and it's not. it's like, it's about a path. And if somebody's going to open a significant door like that, you know, I think most of us think of the biggest moments in our life not being the moment that they got nominated for a Grammy. That's just like, that's frosting. But the other thing is going to be that first session that you had that opened the door. It's going to be the first person you met in the music business. You know, it's going to be whoever's going to be the, whoever opens the door to like the next part of your journey. So I really like that that's your perspective. Denzel, I mean, before we go to tell your story, you know, when we're talking about how you learned how to be a DJ, you know, after you taught how to be a producer, but you learned how to be a DJ, you know, what's the difference in, you know, in this era between a producer and a DJ?
Yeah, I think now it's like the lines definitely get blurred. There's so many transferable skills as far as like, you know, understanding music, being able to count BPMs and just having taste in what to play, being aware of what people want to hear. I think, yeah, like, you know, for us, DJing has always been something that informed our production so much and really being able to study what people want to listen to and seeing specifically like, okay, let me play this song. Who's dancing? Like, which people are dancing? Are they going to dance to this song? No, like, these three people stopped. Like, why did they stop? Who are those people? You know, getting really deep into that type of thing and, like, you know, getting big into people watching while DJing. But I think, you know, DJing is so much of, like, an instant gratification you know, process where you play a song and like everyone's excited. It'll take you, you know, 5 seconds to cue that song up. And you just downloaded it like earlier that day. But production is so much of a delayed gratification process where you could be working on something for weeks and months and it gets shelved for 2 years and it comes out like, you know, a year after that. And then you get the gratification. So it's like much more of a self-reliance process. Yeah, and being down to go on those journeys without the gratification to keep you going.
Yeah, but our history in DJing, I think is probably one of the most important components to how we figured out how to produce together and how to actually craft a record from that perspective. You know, when me and Den's DJ together, we're looking at people and we're like, how are they dancing to this? You know, we play like a West Coast beat, you know, or a West Coast song that's in 100 BPM. You play an Afrobeat song that's 100 BPM. You play a reggaeton song that's 100 BPM. And every single song might create a different reaction in terms of how people are dancing to it. And that, I think, really informed us how to approach making music. And especially, you know, this last 2 years of like the TikTok boom and the TikTok era and all, you know, people really showcasing dance, you know, in front of their iPhone, in front of their camera phone, and being able to study those things and being like, okay, maybe if we place a kick here or place a snare here or play this synth lead line this way, this is the type of reaction that we want to get from it based on all the knowledge and all the studying that we did, like actually physically seeing people react to music in front of us, you know, and me and Denz are like huge geeks when it comes to like music history and like seeing how people move and like rhythm and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's been a huge part of how, you know, fast forward to 2022, how we've really developed our style of production is based on really our eyewitness of how people react to things in real life, you know, and really basing it off of, you know, how people have fun to music. You know, how people build an emotional attachment to music, like all these kind of things. So
we've done probably 170 episodes. And I think that that's probably the most important piece of information that you can get in maybe any episode, which is that, you know, I try to explain how little, like it's how important it is to throw away your ego when you go into a room. And even for an artist, your whole objective is how can you make your fans enjoy their experience? Are they watching you? Are they dancing to you? Are they like, what is your goal as an artist? And as a producer and a writer, your job isn't to placate to the label or to the artist. It's only to the fans. If you can understand how people want to enjoy their hour at this show, or how they're going to enjoy listening to this record in a car, or if they're going to be listening to headphones or whatever it is, you have to understand who the listener is to write good songs. And so, like, the fact that you guys are saying that and have had that experience is so wise and will only just, like, help your career, you know, over the next 25, 30 years, because you'll just continue to see more people listen to more kinds of music, and it'll be, oh, that's interesting, because you can use that influence from this genre to that genre, as you guys already know, you know. But I love that you guys said that. Denzel, tell me a little bit about your life.
Yeah, so I grew up in New Jersey.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Jersey. I was born in Brooklyn. My parents moved to New Jersey just so it would be like a safer place to grow up. And the first town that I lived in was Union, New Jersey, which is like coincidentally where Neesha and like Halsey are from, the same town. And I went to a music school, like a summer camp music school, super early on. I think it was like before kindergarten, like before I went to school for the first time in New Jersey. It was this summer program where I met, like, you know, a bunch of my friends that I had, you know, even to this day when I was like, you know, 4 years old. And I think my parents sent me there because before that I would just, like, you know, get a bunch of pots from the kitchen and start playing them like drums, or, you know, always seemingly gravitated towards music. So that really jump-started my, you know, knowledge about music and or a bunch of different classes. And this is like a music school I went to for like years. Every summer I would go to this, and there would be like jazz improv classes and you know, learning how to read music, learning how to write music. It's pretty like rare now that I think about it. Like, I can't imagine that still exists, or anything like that still exists for like babies to go to all the way up to like high school. There'd be like plays, and I'm in the play and doing all this type of stuff. So when school started, or music started in like the public schools that I was going to, it was like, oh, like, let me teach you how to play the trumpet. Or like, you know, I signed up to play trumpet, and like everyone's learning like, oh, how to hold the trumpet. I'm like, oh yeah, I could like run through scales like nothing. I've been doing this for years. So I've always been like, because of that, I was always, you know, a little ahead. And, you know, I was in third grade and playing in like fourth grade, fifth grade band. So it was always something that was easy and fun to me because I had been doing it. And I moved to this other town after fourth grade, Hillsborough, New Jersey, because Union started to get, you know, a little bit sketchy at times. And that was like a completely different environment. It was like a culture shock. It was like literally the middle of nowhere, like farms and turkey roaming around and deer, and being like the only black kid there. So it was definitely like going from Union, which is like, you know, right by the New York City, and, you know, everyone looks like me, to a place where no one looks like me. And then, you know, I wasn't like instantly accepted there. So I spent like a lot of time just on my own, you know, just go to school, come home, and I'm on my own, you know, every day over the weekend, and, you know, repeat. So through that time of just having a lot of time alone, I would just, you know, continue to learn as much about music as I could, and sign up for like drum lessons and, you know, trumpet lessons, bass guitar lessons, and spent all my time doing that up until YouTube came out. And around that time, I was playing drums in the church. And, you know, I was cool with, like, the music director of the church. And we'd, you know, have rehearsals and stuff. And I knew that he was a producer. His name is Noel Goring. And he produced, like, the R&B singer Joe and, you know, like, a ton of, like, big R&B artists before. And he kind of, like, stopped producing to work for the church. And because I had been learning so much on YouTube, which was, like, completely new at that point, I went from just playing drums in the church to being like, oh, yeah, just check out this, like, CD I made with my mom, like, with my mom's laptop, her work laptop. I downloaded, like, FL on, and I had, like, just doing all these, like, super intricate beats. And he was like, so you did this on your mom's laptop. You should come by my studio. So I would go to his studio every week, and he had a studio in his house, and he would teach me Logic and how to play keys, and we'd, like, record artists. Like, we made a Christmas album when I'm, like, in high school. And then through YouTube, I was, like, watching tutorials and, like, seeing Ryan Leslie for the first time, like, blowing my mind. Like, oh, my God, like, he's doing these things with these different instruments. Like, I could do that. So then I started making tutorials of how to make other people's beats. And I made one that was, like, how to make a DJ Khaled beat. I was like, oh, like, you know, DJ Khaled doesn't even make his beats. It's really, like, the Runners and the Incredibles, blah, 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 all this stuff. And then the one of Khaled's producers, the Incredibles, saw it and was like, oh, wow, like, you're pretty dope. Like, we should link up. So they came to New Jersey and we started working together. And then we were going to, like, Atlanta and working with 2 Chainz and, like, when he was still Titty Boy, and I'm just, like, in high school. My parents are like, what is going on? Like, you're just in a basement. Now people are, like, flying you to Atlanta to, like, work in studios and stuff. And I'm, like, pitching beats all over the place and getting super into it just in high school. And, like, no one in my high school knows. I'm just, like, the quiet kid that, like, sits by himself and is on his laptop. I was the first kid in my entire high school to bring a laptop to school. I would just, like, always, you know, live my life through the computer, which, you know, once production started becoming, like, a thing, I was just so happy to always be on my computer. And, like, eventually I got my own computer. I'm, like, bringing it to school, and people are like, why does this kid have, like, a laptop in school? Like, he's, like, a little businessman, like, bringing a laptop. There's, like, no computer rules. There's, like, because, you know, no one even had that. So I was, you know, just doing whatever I want in that capacity. And then when it was time to apply to colleges, my grades weren't the best. Like, I really didn't care about school, and it wasn't, like, the best time for me. So I just, like, you know, my grades weren't great. But then my mom was like, oh, this is, you know, school program that is just about things that you love to do already. So I remember my parents being like, yeah, like, we could go for a tour, but, you know, it's NYU. Like, you know, you're grades aren't the best. So I remember at that point I was like, okay, like, let me try to put this together. So I went to, like, every class that I had, like, a B or a C or a D, and was like, what's something I could do for extra credit that would improve my grade? I'm down to do anything. Could I do, like, a song or, like, a video project or, like, put together a thing? And I did, like, extra credit, like, making songs for, like, all these different classes and doing the entire periodic table in song form, and, like, the teacher being able to use that to teach. And all my grades went back up. I got so much extra credit, just, like, getting extra hundreds added to my grade. And then, I remember one day, you know, I wrote my college essay for NYU. I only applied to, like, 2 or 3 schools, and 2 of them were backups. And I was like, you know, if I get into NYU, I get into NYU. But, you know, if not, I'll stay in New Jersey and keep doing what I'm doing. And I wrote my essay on this Travis Porter song, which is so funny, like, thinking back. It's, like, all the way turned up by Travis Porter. It was so funny that I wrote a college essay on that. But I wrote that and sent in, like, some of the beats I was working on, and, like, put together this video because I was already, like, you know, getting good at editing and Final Cut and all these things. And I'm just, like, in my, I set up, like, a little studio in my parents' basement, just, like, KRKs and, you know, the laptop that I got. And I got that email. It was like, you're accepted to NYU. I'm like, is this even real? Like, this is not like a
spam.
Real email. Yes, this must be spam. I was like, nah. And then I like closed it for a little bit, just went back to making some beats. And I'm like, wait a minute. Does this mean like I'm going to NYU in a few months? Like, am I moving out of New Jersey and going to NYU? And I showed my parents and I was just like, look, I got this email. And they're like, oh my God. Yeah. And then I was like, oh yeah, that's dope. Yeah, this is gonna be crazy. And yeah, then yep, a few months after that, it's moving to New York City.
Have you guys gone back since to teach or to talk at the school?
We did a couple things like during COVID. So it's been mainly Zooms and things like that. But it's definitely on the horizon now that things are starting to open up again to do something in person, you know?
Yeah, that's like the next thing is when you go back to your alma mater and you're like, because I just remember that freshman year where there was this one teacher that was like, how many of you guys, you know, think you're going to make it in the music business? And a lot of people wanted to be like managers and stuff. And, you know, but how many people want to make music? And I raised my hand with like 10 other people and they're like, you have a better shot at getting struck by lightning. And I was like, that's how like the school started. So it was like, it was nice to be able to go back and be like, I guess I got struck by lightning a couple times. So you guys are at NYU, you know, your histories are unique and yet similar in some ways. Like, I think, as you were saying, like being in Burlington and being in the middle of nowhere, New Jersey, and both being, you know, not, you know, like you were saying, like one of the only black guys in Burlington and the only black guy in that part of New Jersey.
Yeah, a few more moved in after, but yeah, there's a few
but,
of them.
But I think like the, you know, what happens a lot when you enter the music business is that people pigeonhole you one way or the other. Did you find that going to school, you know, if you're studying, you know, you're a drummer in a church band, you're playing music in a jazz band, you're doing EDM DJing stuff, you're doing all kinds of music that's really versatile. It's all kinds of different genres. It's not, you know, even if you're doing stuff with 2 Chainz, or even if you're doing, you know, you study hip hop, it's not the only music that either of you do, which now you guys have, you know, your discography shows that you can do a lot of different music. But did you find that people would assume the kind of music you would do because of who you are?
100%.
Absolutely.
That was like the biggest thing, you know. I think when we started Take a Day Trip, a lot of our mission was to change the narrative on that, you know. And when we really started to get into the music industry as producers, we were fortunate enough to you know, make a splash with this artist named Rory on this song called Cigarette Song, which is more of like a more rooted in like folk music, I'd say, than hip hop, you know. And that was our entrance into music. So it was kind of cool for us to come in from a lens of not being hip hop producers right at the front, but even still coming in the gate with that song, people still wanted to pigeonhole us and push us into rooms where it's just really other black people, you know? And we were really fortunate enough to make incredible music with people of color, you know, from Mo Bamba to, you know, early songs like Kung Fu with Cordae and, you know, Lil Boat with 88 Glam and, you know, all these records that we're so proud of, like super proud of, you know, all the early stuff with Juice WRLD, all that kind of stuff. And really records that were like dreams come true, you know, like we were in the a basement studio in New York, just every single day for like 12, 13, 14 hours a day, just making beats and trying to get a start in the world that accepted us first. And once that world accepted us, that's when we looked at each other and was like, you remember where we started with Rory? We want to get back to that and continue to change the narrative, you know? And we were fortunate enough to have opportunities with like Miley Cyrus and a record with Vince Staples for the Spider-Verse movie that isn't, you know, a super like rap record. It's very much like a cinematic record.
And
Dua Lipa, like Good in Bed. And then eventually with Nas, like to this day, people still call Me By Your Name a rap record. Like, you know, there is rap on it. But like, come on, guys.
I think that's exactly it. Is also like the way people define things. I mean, this will be really hard to explain in the podcast, but I was showing you guys the Super Bowl shuffle.
exactly.
For the Bears, and that getting a Grammy nomination for Best R&B is just as exactly what happens when you have people defining what music is. And there's that great expression of talking about music is like dancing about architecture.
and
it's like when you're well studied in music and history and you're into all these different genres, it's like you're just you're using all these influences to make music, and this is actually a good era for producers like that, because if you were 20 years ago where there were just aisles and stores and aisles and stores, it's hard to put Lil Nas X in an aisle. That's what makes him so special. And a lot of those records that kind of straddle different genres, that's what makes it good, but that also makes it really hard to define. And genres obviously still exist, especially with radio, but you know, it's just a much more of like a sea of, is the song good or not?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
how unique is it? But wait, this is like probably the dumbest journalistic kind of question, but where does Take a Day Trip come from? Like, why not just Day Trip?
Well,
where did it come from?
Well, when we, so David and I were just working together in New York, and you know, we're in college, we're going to different places, and I think we really gravitated toward each other because we were from small towns and we're like in the city now, so our, you know, the thing that we really wanted to do the most was just experience the most life as we could, because now we have the ability to. So we're going to like sketchy studios in Bushwick, and we're like traveling all around. We're going to Miami with like no money and trying to figure it out just to go for like Winter Music Conference and Ultra. Like, we have no passes, we have nothing, and we're just like finessing into places. Like, do you know who I am? Like, my friend's the DJ for tonight. Like, he's calling me right now. He's gonna be so upset that you're not letting us in. They'll be like, oh, I mean, I guess, like, sure, I just got hired at this security job yesterday, go right ahead.
Meanwhile, we're under 21 with no fake ID.
Yeah, with no fake ID, and we were just like figuring things out and trying to take in as much information and as much influence as possible, and you know, really just trying to bring in as much inspiration as we could from experience. So that when we sat down with our friend John Tanners, who's now our manager, he was like, so what do you guys want to do? Like, what, you can, you know, this is something, you guys are making all this music together, what do you want to call it? And we were writing down things that we were inspired by, and you know, a lot of words that had to do with travel. And the last one, it was like this long list of names and words that John was writing down on paper, and like the last one is Day Trip. And we were like, yeah, like we like to go places, and the places that we go influence our music. So that's, there's something there. So we had, we were like, all right, we're going to call ourselves Day Trip. And then, you know, there was like another Day Trip, and we had the email. They were like, we couldn't get the email, like daytrip@gmail.com. Obviously our email is takeadaytrip@gmail.com, but like, we're probably going to have to change that. But yeah, that was like our first email. And when we had to like figure out what we were going to shift our name to, we were like, all right, let's do Take a Day Trip, because we had already been using that a little bit. So to make it more unique than the other day trips that exist in the world.
Yeah, we started a hashtag on Instagram super early on where it was like hashtag Take a Day Trip. And it was like our college project was and we started a lot of it pretty early on, you mm-hmm. know, and right during like the early Rory days where, you know, the idea was to go to a different city every single month and release a song that was inspired and based off what we experienced in that city. You know, obviously it's not something that we're doing still, but I think that really informed a lot of our habits of what we geek out on with music. Like, we love studying like the history of places. It's like, even this week we're working with this producer that I can't say his name right at this moment, but he was talking about how a lot of dub music in Jamaica, for instance, where you get those bass sounds that are kind of like boom, 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 like everything's like kind of muffled and covered. And he was talking to us about how a lot of those things happen because it was actually just the quality of speakers that they actually had. So when they're listening to music, that's just what they thought bass sounded like. So then you have, you know, Lee Scratch Perry and all these people end up making music that is actually sounding like that because that's what they're hearing because of everything else that, you know, they think that's what it hear that, that what it sounds like, you know? And I think things like that, you know, really just made us be like, wow, this is like, you know, hearing things like, you know, throughout our college career and everything like that, those were the things that made us excited about music and excited about the idea of going out to places and experiencing places and learning about the culture and learning about the music history. Like, why did this genre become a genre here? Why did this artist become an artist here? What was politically happening in that place and all these things? And really taking all that energy and all that knowledge. And, you know, the dream was to work with local people and all that kind of stuff to create like one song for 1 month in whatever place we went. And, you know, we realized very early on as two college kids that didn't have any money that that was really fucking expensive and we just could not do that, you know? So we stopped pretty quickly. And, you know,
but you guys were, I mean, you guys were releasing the music as the artist, which really kind of explains the importance of the name too. It's like, you guys are actually releasing the music. And that plan is still something you guys could do, especially because now you've worked with so many big artists. You could easily do, like, take a day trip and find a bunch of these artists from different cities right. that you love and now do it, like, really blow it up.
We always check back in, like, every year or year and a half or so, like, is now the time that we should do that project? Like, because that was always our dream. Like, the only reason that we even produce music for other people initially was to raise enough money to do that project. To go to like a different city every month.
So why don't you do that? I can guarantee you there are a bunch of people listening to this that would love to help fund you guys doing a countrywide, worldwide
it's a
record like that.
It's definitely on of the mind, you know. I think
nice. Well,
I think at the moment it's our purpose in life is to help Lil Nas X's dreams come true, you know, and we're just the team that you know helps put these mm-hmm. these important records together for the world, you know.
Absolutely.
But
totally, I mean, like, the you know, going to, you know, the records that really do end up spreading throughout the world, you did a bunch of things on some records that were you must have been working on them while you were in school or right when you graduated, some that actually went platinum. I'm sure there was, you know, this feeling of like, we can do this. There had to be a lot of encouragement during those later parts of NYU and early parts out of NYU where you are making enough money to kind of survive at least, you know. But there's sort of a difference between even an album track on like the Black Album, you know, or something like that where you have like, you know, Quavo is obviously huge. You know, you get these like some pretty decent size. You know, I know he was on the A-Track record and stuff. Like, you have like at the time you're having a bunch of these big names, but the big names really, they mean something to move your career on. But it's different when you have something like Mo Bamba, which just takes off and is like a whole other thing. And it's so weird because, like, if you listen to, like, the music that you had released up until then and the music since then, it's so seemingly simplistic and you know, it's not overcrowded. It's really, like, you chose, like, the right amount of things and the right amount of vocal production. It's, like, it's just super tasteful. But if I heard that song next to some of the other records, I don't know that I'd be like, if I didn't know that it was going to be successful, like, wow, this is going to be just a giant smash. Tell me a little bit about watching that song go, because I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but my guess is that you didn't think that this was the song that was going to blow open an entire career, you know, when you were getting in the rooms with some of these really big name kind of artist. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think when we started, our mind was kind of split into two different purposes for production. Because when we started, you know, this was pre-Spotify era that we're in now, where everything is like categorized in playlists and things just end up rising to the top on their own. And hip hop wasn't in the place that it is now. So when we signed our first publishing deal, we're like, all right, we're doing this because we want to raise enough money to travel around the world. So we'll do what they want us to do. So we're going to like writing camps and really pushing, they were pushing us towards doing more pop stuff, like stuff that's going to make money for the publishing company. So we didn't really get that many rap sessions. It just wasn't the vibe then. It was a lot of, yeah, just like pitch songs to like send to like whatever was the biggest artist was then. And then we were doing that for a little bit, and you know, we built like a little studio in New York, and we're like, all right, like, well, we don't have a session today. Maybe we could just have one of our friends come over. You know, our manager, John Tanner's, found this artist, Trees O'Keefe from Virginia. He's like so fire. Maybe like we'll work on like our side, like a little rap project on the side, and do that for fun. And through doing these pop sessions, which really like, you know, it was like boot camp, learning about different ways of production and songwriting, and developing those skills there, and having certain records come out, and then, you know, we were doing our thing, and we were like, you know, we want to listen to these songs, you know, at a barbecue or something. Like, let's see if we could figure out a way for them to get on Spotify as well. And I remember we put out a couple songs with our friend Trees Low-Key, who's from Virginia, that our manager found. And we became, like, really close friends, and we just, like, you know, it was just fun. It's like, these are the songs that we were going to play with our friends. So we put, like, a couple of them out. And then we wake up one morning and it's like, whoa, like, did you see that the Tree song is on the viral chart on Spotify? Like, I never even heard of the viral chart on Spotify. What does that even mean? And I remember it came out the same day, like, we put it up on Spotify the same day, like, another, like, pop song that we did came out. And it was just, like, out streaming like crazy. And it's like, people are hitting us up like, yo, that Tree's O'Key song, like, I don't mind, it's going crazy. Like, that's so fire. And then we're like, oh, like, you know, maybe it's possible that there's some, the stuff that we really find fun could be the things that actually make us money and pull us along this journey. So then our thought process kind of switched and was like, all right, let's just do these things, like, for the culture. Let's do things that when we go to DJ, that's going to be what we're going to play. Mm-hmm. And we were DJing a lot at that time, you know, just trying to survive in New York and make our little $300-$500 a night. And, you know, we're playing, like, Hot Nigga. It's like, oh, my God, like, the place explodes. Like, whoa, like, that's crazy. Like, this song really does that every time. Bodak, Yellow, you know, these certain New York songs. Like, being in New York, you drop that one New York song. It's like, oh, everything is going crazy. And we were, like, talking amongst ourselves, like, you know, we need one of these records. We need to do something like that. That's going to really just, like, shake up the culture. Mm-hmm. So we're doing a lot of, like, you know, shots on goal of just things that are cool, like, you know, Rocky and Ferg were going crazy at the time. We're having mosh pits at, like, apartment parties. Like, the floors are, like, caving in. We're like, man, like, that's the vibe. Like, the pop stuff is cool. We'll do that when we get to it. But we'll just do stuff that's going to be fun to listen to in a sweaty basement. So when we did that record, it definitely had that vibe. It was like, oh, yeah, this is, like, you know, fuck the rules. Like, we're just doing this to have fun. We don't care what the pop, you know, listener is listening to right now. This is just for us. Like, this is just for us to play with our friends. And definitely people were like, yo, what is going on with this song? Like, there's no format, no structure.
Yeah, especially early on. I mean, that record came out in June 2017 and didn't become a hit until, like, fall 2019. You know, like, it took a long time. And I remember, like, during that summer, like, 2017, like, into fall, every now and then, you know, Ali, who's, like, Ali with the motherfucking dope, like, we'd run into him every single time, and he'd be like, yo, like, I was at a party in Brooklyn, and, like, Mo Bamba, like, got played, and, like, the place went off. And me and Denz were like, wow, that's crazy.
That's,
like,
crazy.
We weren't there, so, like, we have no idea, like, what that means or what that looks like, mm-hmm. You know?
And then one day, I'm in the studio was like a Saturday, like at night, you know, I wasn't really doing anything. And our friend Mel is friends with Yes Jules, and she came by and she was like throwing parties around the city. I was like, oh, wow, that's dope. Like, it's Yes Jules. And I'm like working on this beat. And then she's sitting in the back just, you know, doing work on her laptop. And she's like, oh, this reminds me of this song. Like, it's like a really cool vibe. Like, have you heard this song, Mo Bamba? I'm like, oh, yeah, I know that song. How do you know that song? She's like, oh, yeah, that song is so sick. Like, I love it. It's just so interesting. I'm like, well, yeah, actually, we made that song in this room that you're in right now. She's like, what? No way. Like, I'm having this party next week for Fashion Week. You guys have to DJ. Like, I had no idea. And we're like, all right, yeah, sure. Like, we'll DJ. Like, you know, $500 can't hurt. And we pull up. I remember Kerwin Frost is DJing and like Spaghetti Boys. It's like some real downtown underneath One Oak, not even in One Oak. Some real, you know, Fashion Week. Trinidad James is there and 6ix9ine and all these things. And we're, you know, this is like one of the biggest parties that we've DJed because it is Fashion Week. And Yes Jules booked us and we're like kind of nervous to get into it. But Kerwin, we're upstairs and Kerwin plays Mo Bamba. We're like, what? Like, how does he know Mo Bamba? And we're hearing like the floor start shaking under us. And we're like, what? Like, why? And then the next DJ goes and they play Mo Bamba too. I'm like, what? Two times in the same night? Like, that's so weird. And then we're starting to hear like people screaming. We're not even in the room. We're just like upstairs in the actual like One Oak, just like chilling, waiting to go downstairs for our set. And we get down there, it's like completely packed. And then we get on. We're like, hey, we're like, take a day trip. You know, we're, you know, from here, and we're gonna play this song that we just did. And we just like drop Mo Bamba as like the first song. And we're thinking it's gonna be like, oh yeah, dope. As soon as we play it, like ding ding ding, people are like, oh. People like throwing like chairs across the room and like jumping off of things, and then the chorus hits and like everyone is going crazy, like just throwing things around, throwing drinks, and like having a mosh pit. Like an entire club just turns into a mosh pit, and we're like, what is going on? And we brought this song back like a few times, but
I think that moment, you know, going back to talking about special moments, and you know, when I got into Clive, like that moment felt the exact same.
That was like that. I remember getting home and like not being able to sleep at all. I'm just looking at everyone's stories that were at, you know, the event that night, and they're all posting Mo Bamba, like the when we dropped Mo Bamba, and I just like could not sleep. I was up to like 5 o'clock in the morning.
It was the first time that we actually, and this was February 2018 during Fashion Week, so you know the song had already been out since June 2017. So all this time had gone by where me and Denzel had not seen that song react in any room ever until we had the moment to DJ and play it for the first time. And, you know, Ali's there, like he's like on tables, like jumping up and down. Like we had been working with Nick Cannon on music a bunch, and he's like literally right behind us. Like his mind is like blown. He's like, what is going on? Like, you know, it's like the 6ix9ine era where like 6ix9ine's really big, like, you know, Goldlink had like crew going on, like that was like the time of music, you know, and all these people are in the room. So like for me and Denz, it was also special because there's like legitimate people that we want to reach and we want to talk to that are also experiencing this moment as we're playing our record that we made with Sheck West.
Yeah, as soon as we like leave, everyone's like, yo, we got a link, man. Yo, we got to link up. We got to. And we're like, yo, that's like, this is everything. This is what we want more than anything. Like the, you know, big radio song with an artist that is like super well known, I'm sure that would be really cool too. But the feeling that we were always chasing and that we still chase is that exact feeling when something reacts like that in real life and really means something to people specifically.
Yeah, that night and the couple of days after, like I've never held my head higher, you know. It was like one of those moments where you're like, oh, like I'm proud of what we're doing. Like I we're shocked. Like, it was definitely, like, shocking, but, like, we're like, this is something that maybe, like, the dream is actually starting to become alive, you know? And I remember, for me personally, that night was really crazy because, like, my family dog of, like, 14 years, like, passed away that same exact night. And, like, right before, like, we were getting ready to DJ, like, my mom calls me on the phone. Like, she's like, oh, like, you know, and my mom was out of town, like, wasn't with my dad, and, like, you know, delivers the news that our family dog Champ had just passed away. And, like, my dad calls me on, like, or I call my dad right after, and like he's bawling, crying, and like, you know, telling me that like Champ passed away in his arms and like all these things, and like have this moment of just like, you know, that dog meant so much to me, like having this moment of just like, I don't even know if I can actually do this, you know? And honestly, like hearing Mo Bamba played by Kerwin and like Lucas Abad and like the other, I forget who else was DJing that
night. Dallas, probably.
But seeing that song or hearing that song, you know, and actually being like, oh shit, like that's something that we did, and is like, I can actually hear people like reacting to this song. It gave me a little bit extra energy to like keep going through that night. And for me personally, it's like one of those like, you know, God moments that's like, it's giving you like a moment of like, almost like my family dog like brought this energy into this room, was just like, yo, run with that shit, you know, like you were so great in my life, like keep going, you know. And that I like, I think about that all the time, like it was just like out of all days, you know, out of all nights. And that like this song that had been sitting really on our laptops and on SoundCloud since like June 2017, it came out 2 days after we made it. You know, like we've told the story before how it's like one take, you know, laptop freezes, like all these chance things. And me and Denzel used to always look at each other like, one day out of all these years that we spent in New York, out of all these years grinding in New York, just like trying to chase our dream, like we want a record like Hot Nigga. Like we want a record like Bodak Yellow. Like we want something that like touches New York at its core, you know? And seeing it react in that moment with like a room full of people that we've been trying to interact with, like, you know, Nick Cannon in the back of us, like a room full of all these kids we went to college with, like all these kids that we met after college, like, you know, family, like family in the room and like all this stuff. And just like finally being able to like almost release all that energy out with a song that allows you to release a lot of energy out was such a special moment, you know? And I think in a lot of ways, like, Grammy nominations, awards, like all that kind of stuff, even number ones, like special, but that moment is, it's like untouchable, yeah. You know, like it was the first moment that we were like, it like coming, like going from like our old farm towns where like, you know, Vermont's 98% white, like you grew up in like probably a 98% white, like yeah. Farm town, like being these only black kids that just wanted to be a part of a bigger world and be a part of a world that also had people that look like us. You know, and being able to step into New York and get to understand New York, get to learn New York, get to learn the culture of New York, and then have a dream of wanting to make a song that touches New York. And then after all these years, like 2018, like we started school in 2011, graduated in 2014, and 4 years later, finally have that moment with all our family, all our friends, like mm-hmm. all these people that at the beginning believed in us, like Nick Cannon at the beginning believed in us, like, you know, and then all these New York icons and things like that are like to the left of us, and finally have that breakthrough moment of being like, maybe we can actually do this.
It felt like the entire years that we're in New York, it's like we're trying all these keys and all these different doors. We're going to every door. We're trying it with every single key we have. It's like we're not getting anywhere. Nothing is working. And that one night that we dropped Mo Bamba, we put the key in the door, turn it, and the door just breaks off the hinges. And we're like, okay.
Yeah.
It's always it's so weird because you can't predict why certain songs touch people, because it's not like that was the only time you tried it, and then but for that one to hit and then to be able to experience it from the artist perspective, being able to actually be the DJ and see it from the stage is something. But like it's one of the parts of the last few years that if you had a hit in the last few years, you didn't see it happen. You didn't hear it with other people because there weren't festivals, there weren't concerts, there weren't anything. So like people were listening in their car, they were listening on at home or whatever it was, but they weren't, you didn't get a chance to be in a room that was crowded with people. So like the fact that you guys were able to experience it a few times even before everything that went down the last couple of years is amazing. And I mean, you went from that song to something that became a little more mainstream. If Lil Nas X at the time was mainstream, he really ended up, you know, striking a chord, but then you kind of pull it back to this like really authentic kind of record form with Panini. That thing was also just, I think at that point you had to have, unlike the other one where it was, it you know, where I think it was probably, there's some random story in it. This one had to feel like you know, you knew it when you were done with it that this was going to be something. Or am I wrong with that?
You're talking about Panini, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Like, it's crazy how that record happened, because that was also like a...
So serendipitous.
Yeah, like how Mo Bamba came out 2 days later, obviously, like, took a while to bubble. Panini, the snippet, came out literally before we left the studio session. Yeah. Like, we didn't even record the second verse yet. Like, we came in, like, we were fortunate enough to have built, like, an incredible relationship with Dot the Genius beforehand. And actually, today is a really special day, because the first record that we ever made with Kid Cudi, and the first record that really started our relationship with Dot the Genius, this record, Do What I Want, that just came out today, which is a beat that we made in, like, 2018. We made an early pack for Dot the Genius, maybe like 2019 or something like that. And then our relationship started to blossom from there, because, you know, Dot eventually delivers the news that Cudi loves this beat. He recorded a song to it. And from there...
he wants to invite you to the studio. We're like, what? Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, and from there, but from there, we just built this incredible collaborative relationship with Dot the Genius, just making idea on top of idea on top of idea. You know, in hopes that we get more records with Cudi, and in hopes that we get more records with other artists. But within that crop of records, like, one of our earliest studio sessions, we made that Panini beat, you know? And fast forward to, you know, I want to say it was sometime top of April. Our A&R, James Supreme, who was our A&R at the time at Universal, was like, hey, like, I know you guys are in L.A., there's a new artist, you might have heard of him, Lil Nas X, that has a song called Old Town Road that, like, just went number one this week, you know? And it's his first time in LA. It's also your opportunity to have his first studio session ever, you know? And me and Denz are like, we have nothing going on today, so, like, sure, why not? Like, let's go, you know? And, like, pull up to the...
How crazy. Like, had it been, like, Thursday or something like that, and you were in with whoever that artist is, you would have been like... Sorry, man, we can't do it today. Like,
yeah, literally, if we had anything on the schedule, we wouldn't have done it.
Anything else. And it's not, and no offense to him, it's just like, that's just the way it is, that if your schedule happens to be open,
your life
changed. Right. Like,
and it happened
that.
To be open.
The only thing we had that day was a meeting with someone who, with our publicist, and that was like our first time meeting him. We go to this restaurant and we see
there's a funny backstory to
this. See Nas, like, Nas is at, like, big Nas, like, OG Nas at the restaurant. Yeah, we're like, what? Nas is here. And then we're getting pasta. We get, like, beef pasta, and we go over to the studio, and we're working with Lil Nas, and we have, like, a bunch of you know, like, country type beats already prepared. We play him, like, a bunch of things, and he's not really gravitating towards anything, and he's like, you know, I just kind of want something different. Like, I want the most weird, different thing that you have.
Yeah, he said he wanted something futuristic.
Yeah. So then we're thinking, like, oh, we just did a bunch with Dot for Cudi. Like, that's always the vibe with Cudi. So this is one that he didn't pick. And we play the Panini beat, the name of the beat is Beef Pasta. And we just had Beef Pasta, and we just saw Nas, and Big Nas before.
And some backstory on that, like, for the longest time, in order for us to remember our beat names, we started creating, like, the day trip recipes. So every single one of our beats is named after some sort of food. Like, some of them are quirky, some of them are real, like, some, you know, and happened to name this one Beef Pasta. happened to be eating, like, you know, beef bolognese, like, pasta at John and Vinny's, like, the OG Nas is literally, like a couple tables away from us, you know, and we're getting ready to have this session with Lil Nas X. And, you know, going through all the ideas that we had prepared for him, he gives us the prompt of being like, I want something futuristic. And it happens to be the most futuristic beat that we had in our portfolio was this beef pasta beat that we had with Dr. Genius. And, you know, play him this record. And I think the thing that immediately made us realize how special of an artist he is without even knowing the terminology and exactly, you know, being able to identify a kick drum from a snare and a hi-hat, you know, early on in our relationship, he'd be like, oh, like, turn down that hi-hat. It'd be like a snare drum or something like that, you know, like, it was the very beginning of his music knowledge, you know, but without having the terminology and all that kind of stuff, he immediately knew where he wanted the sections to be, you know? So he was sitting down with us. He was like, move this section to here, arrange this part to here, like move this to here, move that to here. And maybe within like 30 minutes, 45 minutes to an hour, you know, within that time frame, he had written out the first verse to the chorus and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. And a pre-chorus. And we're just sitting there like, okay, he had us rearrange all these parts and he wrote this entire thing in his head, but perfectly took a song that was like started with like a chorus and then went to like a, you know, the verse and the pre-chorus next and then like a bridge. He like rearranged it, did like intro, verse, pre-chorus, chorus, and then wrote perfectly to that. And we're like, yo, what is going on? Like, did he just, it took us a minute to even realize like what he just did. I don't think he cognitively knew like he was moving those parts to make that arrangement. But we're like, whoa, like, that's not normal to do that on your first session ever.
Yeah. Especially being so new to music, you know? I mean, like, not Old Town Road is one of, like, the earliest songs he ever made. Like, out of making music in general, like, is maybe, like, song number 13 that he had actually made, you know, in his entire life. And it becomes this massive, like, it's the biggest song ever, you know, in terms of, you know, how many times it's certified platinum, you know? And comes in, like, very new to L.A., first time in L.A., first time having a studio session with any producers, and tells us exactly what he wants, tells us exactly where he wants the parts to be, and goes in and just, you know, record, like, the melodies are perfect, you know? It's like, even the whistle at the very beginning of the record, we're like, this guy whistles flawlessly. Like, we have to keep this in the intro. Like, this is incredible.
And he's like, you sure you like that whistle? We're like, yeah, that's fire. And then we're like, oh, what if you tried to, like, layer the chorus? He's like, what does that mean? It's like, sing it like this, an octave up. He's like, okay, I'll try it. And, like, does it perfectly. He's like, oh, yeah, that's actually pretty fire. So we pretty instantly, like, established that mutual trust. And then he's, like, in the corner, like, oh, can you take this video of me listening to it?
Second verse has not been done at all yet.
So we're like taking this video of him and he's like, okay, dope. And then we go back to like, you know, comping his vocal and then start seeing like all these notifications like all coming in. It's like, yo, that Panini song is crazy. Like literally instantly as we're working on the song, he posted it. He didn't tell us he was posting it. It's just up on the internet and our phones are going crazy. Like, how do you even know this kid? Like this new Old Town Road kid, like blah, 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 this song is crazy.
And I think the really awesome thing about that one too is a lot of people that we looked up to in the music industry started commenting on that one. So, you know, we go to like the Genius page where like they reposted it or like, you know, all these different, you know, different Instagram like blogging pages and things like that and see, you know, I remember Boy Wonder, like we were geeking out over.
Oh,
like,
my, oh God, my God,
Boy like Boy Wonder likes this record, everything like that. And that was another moment where we're like, maybe we can do this, you know?
Yeah, it's one thing when you get that first, you know, there are a lot of people who have a hit. More people who haven't, but there are a lot of people who have a hit. There are very, very, very few people who have two.
Yeah.
Like, if you can get that second one, there are people in the Songwriter Hall of Fame who have two hits. There are people, like, if you have one hit, it's really hard to do that unless you wrote, you know, the biggest song of all time, maybe. But, like, it is so hard to repeat it. And it becomes a thing where you're like, oh, this isn't a fluke. This is legit. And it doesn't matter who... You know, it's frustrating when you hear about somebody being as talented as Lil Nas X because you're like, come on, man. Like, everyone else had to write more than 13 songs, and everyone else went to, like, had to go to school and do, like, you know, not everybody's a savant. But, you know, for most people, like, to earn that second hit is, like, that's the moment when you're like, okay, thank God. You know, like, I know that if all else fails, I did it twice.
Yeah. You know? I think that moment was awesome, too, because so many people were rooting for him ever since he got taken off of, like, the country, you know, Billboard charts and all these things. There's, like, that controversy around the Old Town Road record in terms of the entrance he made into the music industry. He was immediately backlashed in categories where he probably shouldn't have been backlashed from, you know? Like, I remember Texas, like, the basketball team made it, like, all the way to the NCAA, like, championship that year. And, like, Old Town Road was, like, their fight song the whole way through. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to go to the championship because my mom works on the NCAA Division III board. So I'm sitting in the audience and, like, these white dudes with cowboy hats, like, in, you know, the Vikings, you know, stadium are, like, screaming Old Town Road. And I'm like, sitting there, like, these people are reacting to it this way because it's something that touches them in the world that they're from. And all of a sudden, this guy is getting shunned from the charts and all the things that should be accepting him. And, you know, it was at that moment where people were, like, really rooting for him to keep going, you know? And then all, like, Panini snippet goes up, and it was almost like the whole world, like, the whole internet that we looked up to, like, we obsessed over, like, the boy wonders of the world, all that kind of stuff, coming to his side and being like, yes, this kid has more in the tank, you know? Like, this kid is more than just this record, Old Town Road. And in that moment, that was also the moment where we saw that eureka moment of being like, this kid is way more than Old Town Road. Like, we saw him make a record from scratch, from the ground up, and saw his knowledge and his intuition of just how he knows how to make the perfect record for him.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
before you work on Montero, which happens a bit later, you have, like, you start to work on all those other kinds of records. You know, you end up on Future Nostalgia, which is a massive, massive album. I think it might be, like, the most streamed female album of 2021 or 2020, whatever it was. You know, to work on Dua, and then to have, like, Weezer, a number one rock airplay with Weezer, man. Legends, just, like, with Rivers Cuomo. Like, I imagine that there becomes, like, a feeling... Like, maybe this isn't the right word, but did you start thinking it was easy?
The thing that happened, there was a switch that I think happened around the time that we met Nas, where a lot of the things that we were doing before seemed like we were spinning our wheels and getting nowhere. We're putting in so much effort and nothing was changing. And then Nas's outlook on, like, life in general was so different and refreshing because it was like he was just, like, radiating so much positivity and just, like, belief in himself. And then his, like, belief in us at that time was like, wow, like, you know, he's so positively sure that, you know, he's going to be great and we're going to be great. So, like, I think our energy switched from being like, oh, damn, like, nothing's working to, like, well, everything works out so easily for us, you know? Everything is great, and, you know, we do what we want to do, and the things that are supposed to happen, and things that don't happen for, like, a reason. But, you know, with the Dua thing, we had met Dua years before, and we're, like, working on a ton of records for her, and she didn't have anything out, and they just, like, didn't come out. Like, they didn't make the album, and we had been working on the Weezer song, you know, years before, and it's like the different artists cut it and it just never worked.
That song has been reproduced, like, literally 25 times.
So many times, and it's just like nothing was working. And then, after, you know, Mo Bamba and Panini.
And also, you know, we were fortunate enough to work with Juice WRLD super early on, you know, and made Legends and Rich and Blind, you know, obviously on a very unfortunate day. Which is the day that XXXTentacion, you know, was unfortunately shot and killed.
Mm-hmm.
But
that record, we did it, and then it's just like you know, it was like a tough time, and you know, we were in with Juice, and he previewed it, you know, the same night. And when we woke up, it was out. And then, you know, those types of things just started happening more and more, in like these full circle moments, like, oh, well, you worked with Dua for years. The song never came out, but like randomly our A&R is like, oh, you want to work on this Dua song? And we work on it and it comes out. And they're like randomly like, oh, Weezer actually ended up working on this song and making it their own, and it came out. And then all these things started to just like fall
In line. I think it was almost like the momentum of all our hard work finally meeting luck for the first time. Yeah. and just, you know, crash landing, you know, right at this moment where it was like Panini, you know. And I think and, you know, all these other records are starting to circulate that we had been working on for like 3-4 years before that, you know, like even Home, like the Vince Staples record that we made for Spider-Verse is a record that we made with a friend like maybe 2-3 years before that movie even was like being developed.
Yeah.
You know, and just all these moments started to finally start hitting in the center, you know, and a lot of that just came from, I think, you know, our persistence and hard work and just really just having a dream that we wanted to make, you know, make true.
Mm-hmm. And just having good energy. Yeah. And that really changed everything. Things just ended up working out.
I mean, I know like the Scots ends up being like a big moment too. And like you end up with the Travis Scott, Kid Cudi record, and you have a bunch of these songs that kind of come and go, but it's not the same thing as when Montero comes out and it's like, oh, that's, this is like, it came out. And I feel like everybody just assumed that it would be nominated for best album, and it just assumed that it was just so much more unique and honest. And it's honest in a, you know, the fact that he's out and open about it in a community that doesn't always accept people who are out and open, it's got to be a very exciting project to work on, because there's a purpose to it that's bigger than just like doing music.
Yeah.
Like that album to me has so much more importance to it than, you know, another record with another artist or another, like, it wasn't just a pop record. That's a pop record with a purpose. That album comes out and it's like, and those videos are not shy. Like, he's coming out, he's like, I want you to know who I am.
Yeah.
And, you know, you guys as executive producers have to bring that out of him. Tell me a little bit about that, you know, what that experience is, you know, to be a part of an album that in a way is that controversial, and also maybe it's not controversial anymore. I don't know. Yeah. What's it like from your perspective?
You know what I think? I was thinking about this the other day. Like, I think coincidentally, because we went to NYU and we had the experiences growing up that we did of meeting so many different types of people, and like, you know, in NYU, my roommate was gay, you know, like, and there's so many people that are from different backgrounds and different, you know, outlooks on life, different sexualities. Like, it wasn't really a thing to us. It was just like, oh yeah, it's whatever. Like, oh yeah, that's.
I remember in our first session, when we were making Panini, like, you know, when you export a song, obviously it's called like bouncing that, you know. So me and Denz were just like, yo, like bounce that, like, yo, bounce, like, we're just making like bounce that.
Yeah,
records,
and then,
you know?
Nas is like so shy, he's like, bounce that. And we're like, hey, yo, chill, bro, like, bounce what? And we're like making all these jokes back and forth, and like that was like our whole joke the first session. It's like, oh yeah, bounce that for me one time. But it's like a joke, and then, you know, with the 70p comes out. And you know, he comes out with one of the songs like on during Pride Month, and then he texts us because I think he was like nervous. He's like, okay, these are like rap producers. Like, how are they going to perceive me after this? Is this going to change our relationship? And he hits us on text like, oh, I guess we can't do those bounce that jokes anymore. And then we're just like, I guess we're just going to have to bounce it harder.
And literally from that moment, that was just that's when I think all of us became comfortable, you know, or at least when Nas like realized like, oh, these guys like actually rock with me. It's like, we can be homies, we could be best friends, we could be brothers, we can laugh about this stuff, we can joke about this stuff, but at the same time, we can change the world together, you know? And I think working on that record, Montero, like, Nas is a superhero. Like he's legitimately a real life living superhero. Like everything he stands for, everything he says, even just like when he's just standing there, when he's saying nothing, like he represents what the change in the world needs to be, you know? And I think over this last year, we've found a lot of disappointment in, you know, some of these institutions and these establishments of, you know, being nominated or not being nominated at all, not winning in categories that I think we should be winning in. And seeing that happen, it kind of made us realize, like, you know what? If some institutions or some people want to be on the wrong side of history, our job is not to pay attention to that. Our job is actually to change people's lives and make people feel comfortable and make people feel comfortable in their own skin, make people want to be exactly who they want to be, you know? And, you know, especially after the Grammys, going home, like spending all this money on outfits, like getting ready for it, like all this stuff, getting 6 nominations and like just hoping that we'd walk away with one, you know, music video of the year, maybe, you know, just one. And to walk away with 0 awards, you know, and just feel the disappointment of that. And then immediately be like, you know what? Maybe this is a sign that we're actually supposed to be a part of something bigger. You know, it's not for the award shows. It's not for all that stuff. It's actually to make a difference in people's lives, you know, and working with Nas, like he just embodies all of that, you know, like whenever he comes in the studio every single day, it's such a blessing just to be free and creating such free and open music with him, you know, like he just has to be honest. And then me and Dan, through our, you know, decade of studying music and all these kind of things, just have to put it into context that makes sense for the masses, you know? And that's what makes our relationship so beautiful, is because we just have such a connection on what works and what's important to say, and allow the freedom in the room to say, we can all be who we want to be, tell your story, make it real, make it true, and in return, make a fucking incredible video visual that, you know, explains that even more and even further. And me and Denz are always going to be behind you no matter what, you know, like after Call Me By Your Name, oh, you want to make Industry Baby? Cool. We got you. You know, it's like, you want us to do this whole album. You want us to be in with you 5, 6, 7 days a week, countless hours. We got you. Cause we're here to make your dreams come true. We're here to like help you change the world, essentially. Like he's just so important. Like he's truly so important. He's been so important to our lives as well. Like he's just opened so many doors, not, you know, from a work standpoint, but just
human standpoint.
Yeah, just let us see so much of the world, and you know, he's given us so much. And in return, like we're just so grateful and so thankful to be working with someone as incredible as him, you know, truly.
Yeah, going back to the taking your ego out of it, you as a producer and as a songwriter, as a professional, are in the service industry. Your job is not to write your song. It's not to produce your song. It's to write and produce the artist's best song. It's to serve them. It's to serve them, and it's to serve their audience. If you can do that, then you're doing your job well. And I obviously he recognizes it, and obviously you guys do too. I don't, you know, without talking about award shows too much, it's like, you know, I didn't understand it until I was involved in the committee side of things for Grammys for a bit. But man, it is so hard to get nominated. When people say, you know, it's an honor to be nominated, when you see how many albums are trying to be nominated, how many artists are disappointed that they weren't even included in the nomination process, you know, it's like, it's such a win to be nominated. Is it fun to get the award? Sure. But it really is irrelevant, because you're talking about just being accepted amongst the community at that level shows so much movement and acceptance, and a lot more now than ever. So, you know, look, the guy should have been nominated for best country song, you know. Yeah, you know, the guy's been knocked down a number of ways along, you know, but part of that is because he stands alone and is his own genre, and you guys serving him well are keeping him straddled on a number of genres, and that's what makes him, you know, a great artist. So it won't be the last time you guys end up going to, you know, going to the Grammys with him. Let's go to this next section. We're going to go five for five. I'm going to just list five things. I just want to hear your thoughts on them. I'm going to start with Juice WRLD.
One of the most incredible and one of the most talented people we've ever had the opportunity to just stand in a room with. You know, even like when we weren't making music with him, me and Denzel would just stay just to see him, you know, record on 10 other people's beats. Like,
it was like watching the craziest movie you ever seen, just like in real life. It's like watching, you know, someone juggle 14 bowling balls at the same time. It's like, how is he doing that? He would just sit down with the mic. You could play any beat and he's going to do a song from top to bottom with the most intricate bars and melodies at the same time. And it'd just be like, okay, let me try one more time. And then do it again completely differently. And then do that 10 times in a night. All different beats and, you know, different melodies and not reusing the same lines. It's like, it was the craziest thing we've ever seen.
Yeah, it was incredible. It really was, you know. I remember when we made Legends with him and just, you know, the feeling that was overwhelming that room, you know. And it took him a couple takes just to figure out what he was going to do. And then literally one take the whole entire song. And then the second take was just him, you know, lighting a lighter in that moment of silence. And then that was it, you know? And it's like chills, you know, that.
You feel your heart sink when the take ends and it's just like the song is over. And it's like, oh my God, like he just did that all at one time and has all that meaning in it.
Yeah. Like I truly wish he was still here. Like he's just a phenomenal artist, you know, phenomenal person, phenomenal human being. Like he, and in a lot of ways, he was one of the first big artists that made me and Denzel feel confident. Like he really like complimented our beats. I remember when we're working on the first Sonic the Hedgehog movie, and there's a version of the song that, you know, that leaked that has him on it. And I remember pulling up to his house and just like, you know, he was full of compliments. Like he just loved making people feel great. You know, like he'd look at us and just be like, man, I love your beats. Like I love what you guys do. All this kind of stuff. Like, really one of the first artists to make us feel like, wow, like we're being seen by someone who's like legitimately an icon, you know, especially an icon for like his generation and now, you know, an icon for the whole world and all of music, you know, and truly just like a gift to the world, you know, like such an incredible person, incredible talent. And, you know, I really wish he was still here, like truly.
Kid Cudi.
I feel like Cudi is like the source of like a lot of our inspiration musically and just the approach to creativity and in life. And at the beginning, that was like one of our goals. That was like, you know, maybe one day we'll have something with Kid Cudi, and finding all these ways of like, okay, like who knows Cudi? Like maybe let's link with Dot, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the first time hearing him on one of our beats, like we just sent a bunch of beats and we link with Dot, he's like, don't tell anyone I played you this. And it's just like this Cudi song from the first second, we were just like, oh my God, like.
Yeah, and you know, Cudi was someone we grew up on, you know, he was one of the first artists that we grew up on to be like, yo, you're dope, you know. I remember being in high school, like, you know, he performed at some small college like close to Vermont, and like I drove all the way there just to see him, you know, like early day and night days, like 10 deep mixtapes, like all that kind of stuff. Like he's been he's been someone that's like been in our lives for so long, and to actually have the opportunity to sit in front of him, you know, he's like a rare Pokemon, you know. It's like to actually have the opportunity to sit in front of him. And I remember the first studio session we ever had with him, he played us the record that came out today, Do What I Want. And, you know, me and Denzel are just like, holy shit. And it was, you know, Mo Bamba's this massive hit at the time. And I remember he turned to us and he was like, I want you to make me something that is like Mo Bamba in my world. You know, like immediately was like, I'm gonna give you a task and I'm gonna see how you guys interact with this. You know, and he was one of the first like people that we looked up to that came in and was like, I'm gonna give you boys a challenge to see if you can actually hang.
Yeah, he just says that and we're like in this studio, there's like a bunch of keyboards everywhere. He's like, okay, so I want you to do this. And then he just sits down and he's just looking at us and we're like, Oh my God.
Yeah, he really put.
I mean, you guys got homework. He gave you actual homework.
Yeah, and he really pushed because he did that time and time again. Like, he really pushed us every single time we hopped in the room with him. Like, he'd always give us a challenge, and then he'd reveal a story where, you know, the like Kanye and Jay-Z and all the people that when he was a young kid coming into the game with Day and Night, and all he had to his name was Day and Night. People were coming to him like, show us what you can do, you know. Like, show us what you're actually made of. And when he actually proved it, that's when he really started to get his flowers. That's when, you know, all these incredible records that we grew up on were made. You know, that was his, yeah, that was his second experience.
It's that second song. It's that third song. Mm-hmm. It's not the first one. The first one is, like, that's the story. That's the one everyone, you know, that's how one-hit wonders are made. It's the guys who can come back. That's the real wonder. Like, how can you actually write, too, in a world that's filled with all this other stuff?
Yeah.
But speaking, let's go to the next one. NYU Clive Davis Institute.
Probably the most important component of our early journey.
Yeah.
You know, it was really the moment that was like, if you guys want to be in music, here's your opportunity to A, come to a city that doesn't have, you know, three people living in your town. It's like, come be a part of a mecca, you know, where like so much music history is there. You know, when we started in 2011, like, you know, Purple Swag had just come out by ASAP Rocky, like, you know, all like just the coolest shit was happening in New York. You know, it's like Action Bronson starting to pop up, like World's Fair. You have like, you know, the Fool's Gold, you know, festivals that are happening, and like, you know, music was just such a strong component of the energy of New York City, you know, and we're like these 18-year-old kids just wide-eyed, just walking in, just wanting to be a part of that, you know, and NYU and Clive and like giving us an opportunity to learn not just how to make music and how to be in a studio, but also how to interact with lawyers, how to interact with managers, like learning music history, learning like going to legal classes, like having an opportunity to take a class with Questlove all about Prince. You know, like just all these insane opportunities, and like all while like, you know, being in the dorms and just like being rowdy and being a kid and like, you know, just having fun with all these kids that are also chasing their dreams, that are coming to the city and just like want to make art and want to be a part of that. You know, we might have all been like the losers in high school and all that kind of stuff, like all the art school kids. And all of a sudden, like, we're the coolest kids in New York. Like, we're the art school kids, yeah. You know, and like having the time of our lives, man. Like, it was like, it's just so important, you know, like. All the flowers to the Clive Davis Institute, like, it gave us a perspective that I think really launched us into being able to know how to handle every curveball thrown at us, you know?
All right, Denzel, this one's for you. David.
David. I say, like, when we started hanging out, it was like, you know, when you meet someone, it's like a reflection of you, but like in so many different ways. It was like, okay, we're both from small towns, but I don't know anything outside of my circle, but I know this like little piece of information so well. And you know, like all these other things, and they're almost like parallels. Like, oh, have you ever heard of Justice? I'm like, no. And I'm like, oh, have you ever heard of Kirk Franklin? He's like, who? And then we're like putting these things together and, you know, making it, you know, change our perception of the things that we know best. And that's always been like our dynamic. Like, I'll show something to David and then he'll like show it back to me in a different way. I'm like, oh my God, how do you tell me something about that I know that I'm showing you? So that's like, yeah, he's nice with that.
David, Denzel.
I mean, you know, reflecting a lot of things that he just said, I think, the amount of doors and the amount of perspectives that Denzel has opened up to me that has not only informed and boosted my own confidence as a musician, it like he really showed me a path of where I can go and really like showcase my skill sets and also grow within that, you know? Like, I think in a lot of ways, like, we're, you know, very, very incredible in our own ways of what we're best at in music, you know? And I look at Denzel and I'm just like, he's a rhythm god, you know? Like, there's no one on planet Earth that I think touches Denzel when it comes to his ability to make drums in any genre that you ask him to make them in, you know? And our chemistry on keyboards, like our ability to just look at each other's eyes and like not say a word and like go to one note and be like, that's exactly where we're supposed to go, you know? But this is my brother for life. Like truly, like this is my family. You know, we've known each other for 11 years now. Like we've experienced so much together, like from being young kids, just like trying to get into events, just trying to chase a dream to all of a sudden like realizing a dream. And then from there realizing that the dream is just literally the beginning. Now we got to prove ourselves in this dream, you know, and being able to look at him and always know that no matter what, we're chasing the same thing for each other, for ourselves. We're always keeping the foot on the pedal together and creating art at the end of the day, like art that is important to us, art that's important to the world, art that has changed our lives. You know, like I truly don't know like if what would have happened if I was 18 and like didn't get accepted to the Clive Davis Institute.
Right? It was like the butterfly effect. Like where would we even be right now?
It's
all those things that we were saying. Like, what would have happened if you just had a session the day that they're like, "Hey, this guy's available tonight," and you're like, "Lil Nas X, okay, well, he's got one song out." It just happens that you know, some of these things you can't control. But what you guys have done, first of all, thank you guys for doing this podcast.
Thank you for having us.
But you know, what you guys have shown is that you seize opportunities, and so one way or another, you guys have continued to go through a lot of these doors together, but you guys are holding each other accountable, and you guys are managing to continue to repeat success because you guys are able to handle that hype. You guys are able to work together and keep each other grounded and focused on what matters. And there's no better evidence than that. Then when you have artists like Kid Cudi or Lil Nas X who keep coming back to you guys, it is so, so hard to develop a relationship over multiple albums with an artist. They often want to try other people. They want to try other things. And that's okay. That's also okay. But it says a lot about you guys wanting to push each other, wanting to push your artists, wanting to be accepting, wanting to open doors. You guys are so smart. It's really fun to watch. You know, I'm glad that we're just meeting like this. I get the feeling that we'll be having these conversations in person soon. But, man, I just really appreciate you guys and what you guys are standing for in the music business. It's good people who are smart. It's just a good recipe for the next, you know, the next generation of the music business. So thank you guys.
Man, thank you so much. Truly.
Yeah, it's an honor to be on this podcast. I remember listening to this when we were down bad in New York, like, wow, this is great information.
Yeah, truly.
Well, there you go.
Truly. But, you know, thank you so much, man, for having us. You know, thank you truly for the kind words. And like, you know, it's really an honor to be able to be on this show and speak to people like you, you know, based on, you know, just trying to do the things that you know, we've been dreaming of in life, you know? So thank you.
There you go. This episode is produced by Joe London, Hypnosis, Mega House Management, and myself. Shout out Paige McDonald, Kelly Fox, Casey Robinson, David Silberstein, Tim Kirchen, Zach Weinstein. See you all next week. I'm Ross Golan, signing off.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.